Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And today on the show, I have got naturopathic doctor Mariah Mosley. And we talk a little bit about naturopathic medicine as well as things that people can do to take ownership over their stuff and really empower them to be able to take care of themselves when things get hard. And I couldn't be more of an advocate for that, as I'm one of those people. Still going strong without the medication, still going strong with a strange new diet and no alcohol. Honestly, I don't really consider myself to be a person who's going to, stay, let's say, completely sober for the rest of my life. I think I'm going to just kind of have a different attitude about alcohol. I was using it to help me sleep. and that's not really the way to go. I still like a glass of wine. I haven't had one in a while, but one of these days I'm going to. I'm sure I will. I don't like to say never. I don't like to deal in absolutes. Since I am a person who can set it aside and come back to it, I feel like that's probably healthy. If you're one of those people who can't have one or two drinks, just don't. You got to know you. And I don't know. It's an interesting thing and a strange position for me to be in, sort of off the medicine and back to trying to hold myself together and looking at a great deal of change. And trying to figure out what I'm going to do as things roll forward. The end of the year is coming, and a decision's going to have to be made here pretty quick about whether or not I'm staying in Denver or it's off to sunny California. It's a hard decision. It's a really hard decision, and it's one that I'm not really excited about, to be honest with you. But here's the thing. I know about me that I'm a change-averse person and that I adapt really well once I finally commit to adapting. And that might be what I have to do here. It might be. But enough about that. I want to thank everybody who's been writing me emails and sending me messages through the Facebook app of encouragement as I walk this path of getting off of medication again and starting to try to figure out some new things about myself. There's always something to learn, and I really appreciate it. And as the season winds down, as we are, man, it's really been a ride. All right, enough about this. I cannot wait for you to hear this conversation. So this is my talk with Dr. Mariah Mosley.
But he was saying it's getting down into the 30s, so that happened. Wow.
Yeah, snowed yesterday, and some of it's still here today. And about mid-afternoon, it got up into the 50s, and tomorrow it's going to be in the 70s. So,
okay, so it won't stay around long. But
yeah, it typically doesn't. But it's to get it this early. This was one of the fastest temperature drops that we've had. It dropped 64 degrees in under 24 hours.
Holy crap! Wow.
Yeah, that's
huge.
Nuts.
What a difference. So tell me a little where I'm from.
Tell me, where are you from?
Oh, I'm from Indiana, but I was going to say that, you know, right now it's one of the hottest, falls and summers. And, back in Indiana, they actually had a drought. And so usually you can have like a good 3 or 4 cuttings of hay, but it was so dry that most people have only been able to get one in. So,
oh, wow.
It's been a real big problem. Yeah.
Do you have a lot of problem with wildfires?
25% of the hay. What?
Do you have a lot of problem with wildfires?
You know, actually, no. I have never once heard of an Indiana fire per se. We have tornadoes. But fires, not like anywhere in Colorado or the Northwest or California, nothing like that.
Right. Yeah. I was just thinking, you know, with all that hay,
yeah,
being so dry
and all the corn and
Oh, yeah. So have you always been there?
Nope. So I just grew up there, and then I went to the university in Indiana, actually, and then I spent some time down in South America, and then I've been out in Arizona for the last five, six years now.
Oh, nice. Yeah. So, I mean, you've got your fair share of heat then.
Oh, yeah. I'm not, 130 in the middle of the day, and then the low of like 105 at night and at midnight. I understand that now. Used to it, I guess.
Well, tell me a little bit about South America. What brought you down there?
So in South America, I actually was studying abroad, and then I just ended up loving it down there. And so I just stayed for longer.
Nice.
And, just worked down there until I went to medical school. So it stole my heart, so I stayed down there for a little bit longer than I intended. But I was always planning on kind of coming back up here to finish medical school, to start and finish medical school anyway.
Well, was that always
the
plan?
Have you done a lot of traveling? Pardon?
Was that always the plan, medical school?
Yeah, ever since I realized I couldn't deal with animals. I grew up on a farm, and I love animals. And, I was debating between, vet and doctor. But I just, it was too emotionally intensive to do animals because I love them so much. And so then I was like, I could do people then instead. So then after that, it was like when I was really young, elementary school, I decided this. But then after that, it's always been on that whole track.
And you followed through with it, though. I mean, that's not nothing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, thanks. Yeah. It was definitely a lot of, the dark nights of the soul kind of moments between, then and now. But, yeah, stuck through with it, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting. My wife was a veterinary technician for a long time. Because she could handle, surgeries and things like that with animals, but can't stand the sight of blood on people.
No way. Yeah. That is hilarious.
Can't even look at a needle. Not on television. Can't even do it. But, animals, no problem.
Was able to do surgeries. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow, on animals.
Yeah, all kinds of... She got a lot of cool experiences out of that, too. Got to go to the large cat rescues, work with tigers and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, lots of crazy things like that. But... So how old were you when you graduated from medical school?
So I actually just graduated a year ago, so 25.
Awesome. Well,
I'm
congratulations.
26 now. Yeah, thank you.
I
was accelerated.
I was going to say, is that pretty young? I mean, it sounds young.
Yeah. I did college in 3 years. Because I just, paying it for it myself and everything. I just kind of wanted to get it through with it pretty quick.
Yeah.
Obviously save money. So I just took a lot of, classes in the summers and before college when I was in the high school, and then just kind of went through it, in 3 years beforehand. So
how do you handle the stress of all that?
My faith, that really was it. And then I found that even like in medical school, I found that when I tried super hard to get like all A's and be perfect, it was too much stress and I would always do worse. But when I started realizing like the work-life balance and kind of just being like, I'll get what I get, then I would get perfect A's and like literally not even touch any schoolwork on the weekends. And so it was really weird, but I found a work-life balance that like worked for me really, really well.
Well, and where did you get that from?
That's how I got through.
Were your parents academically minded people?
Oh yeah. So, both of my parents were teachers. And so, and worked, or were in the same school that I was going to. So, you know, if I got even a little bit of a bad grade, I know that my teacher would tell my mom, and then my mom, you know, would obviously be on me. So,
well, no wonder you wanted to get it over with.
Yeah, speed through this real quick. Nobody breathing down my neck.
That's amazing.
Yeah, thank you.
So what field of it's such a big thing. Like what field of medicine did you like specify in? Are you just a general practitioner or?
Yeah. So well, first off, I always thought I was going to do like allopathic medicine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like conventional medicine, and then I worked actually. During college, I worked as a medical assistant. And so I actually was like one-on-one with patients, pretty much, you know, like right under a nurse, but doing kind of the same, you know, drawing blood, doing vitals, getting them ready to see the doctor. And, for me, you know, it was great because I was, you know, having all this experience, learning a lot from the doctors, and it was a family practice as well. But, you know, for me, I was just like, well, this is kind of weird. Nobody's talking about, you know, like their mental health and like, you know, sleep and their faith and like how much water they're drinking and the fact that they're eating McDonald's every single meal of the day. Because, you know, coming from the Midwest, you know, the health behaviors are very different from out here in the West.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And so, yeah. And so nobody had ever really talked about that to like any of the patients. And so I was kind of, you know, disillusioned by the fact that, you know, the most basic fundamental, you know, aspects of health were never talked about. And so that's kind of, you know, what really drove me into naturopathic medicine instead of allopathic medicine, because naturopathic medicine actually looks at, you know, the root causes of illness, and it kind of recognizes the body has this innate ability to actually heal itself once you give it what it actually needs. So, you know, whether that be neurotransmitter imbalances or, you know, vitamin deficiencies, you know, whatever it like needs to actually grow, and then, you know, sleep, healthy foods, water, you know, basic nutrients for health. It just kind of, you know, picks it up and does the rest of it itself. So that's why I kind of decided to do naturopathic medicine. And then subspecialty of that is I actually just do more of a family practice in Tucson, Arizona. So.
Nice. So, I mean, you mentioned that people don't really talk about their mental health in the Midwest. I mean, I can definitely relate to that. I grew up in Michigan, and it was it was a whole other world.
Yes, you exactly know them. Indiana and Michigan are right there.
Yes, they are. Mm-hmm. So it's a completely different world. It's one of those conversations that I think people are more and more willing to have. It's becoming more of a national mm-hmm. conversation, something that it can't really be ignored anymore. But what was your experience around discussions about mental health growing up? Was that something that was ever really discussed in your house?
No, absolutely not. Granted, I'm a big proponent of, you know, counseling and mental health now. Thankfully, my mom's second marriage was to a counselor, so we all got on that boat really quickly.
Yeah.
But, you know, growing up, nobody talked about, you know, mental health or depression or, you know, for example, with one of my patients, like last week, we were actually helping her child, like five-year-old child, learn emotional regulation, you know?
Yeah.
So like, I'm feeling this emotion, like, where is it coming from? Like, what does it look like? Because children's minds need to kind of like recognize that and learn how to deal with it, you know, with breathing and everything like that. But going back to like where I grew up in Indiana, like we didn't talk about that. You were expected when you got out of the house, you were quiet and you acted perfect when you were outside the house.
Yeah.
You know, like there was no discussions of if you're feeling sad kind of things. No, you look like a perfect little child and you walk in line, kind of thing like that.
Yeah.
So it's very, very different.
Completely. Yeah, I mean,
and I'm sure you had the same kind of thing.
Yeah, when I was a kid, the thing I heard more than anything was, "Stop it! Would you stop that?"
Yes! Yep.
I was a very emotionally all over the place kid. And so, mm-hmm. you know, that had its ups and downs for my parents.
But, oh, yeah.
You know,
and the fact is, yeah, most kids that are having, you know, like the emotional, like way high and then way low
yeah.
are actually very, very intelligent. You know, their emotional intelligence is high. They're feeling everything and they're very intelligent themselves. And, you know, it's just if somebody were to, you know, go back in time and kind of like help, you know, you and both me,
yeah.
like with that emotional regulation back then, can you imagine,
yeah.
you know, how much it would have helped us, you know, later on.
Yeah,
with, like,
absolutely.
Mental health in general.
Well, mm-hmm. it is a thing that needs to be nurtured. It's got mm-hmm. to be, it's got to be fostered and discussed. And because there's a lot
absolutely.
Of ways that you're going to learn how to regulate your own behavior. It's just a matter of whether or
mm-hmm.
not those coping mechanisms and those regulations are actually going to turn out to be a benefit for you.
Exactly. Yes.
So, mm-hmm. so where did you first start getting these pieces to be able to figure that out?
So, I mean, personally, I kind of, you know, grew up in a household where, and you know, as you know, the opioid epidemic is extremely high and problematic in the Midwest,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Especially Ohio, Pennsylvania, and in Indiana. And unfortunately, you know, with my family, we had some, you know, substance abuse kind of things happening, but it was all prescription, so it's all fine because it's from the doctor.
Oh,
and
yeah.
so, you know, seeing
yeah.
that kind of, you know, really high and then really low and all the kind of family distress that can obviously cause really had me kind of wonder, like, what is going on at the doctor's office that they are not, like, or that, you know, they're letting patients leave with this kind of thing happening. And that's kind of really what stimulated my, you know, drive for mental health, as well as, you know, me being an extremely emotional kid. I had to learn somehow outside of the family system to how am I going to deal with my emotions? Because, you know, that's a important thing for, you know, all children, adults, everybody to kind of recognize and learn how to deal with.
Yeah. I mean, talk to me about that a little bit. I'm curious about that aspect of it. When did you first, I guess if you think back, most things are hindsight, you know what I mean? But
mm-hmm.
are you able to trace back the beginnings or the roots of any sort of, let's say, mental health issues?
Yeah, so I think for me, I was a child that never felt anything in the middle. So, like, when I heard no, my mom always would tease me about this, and, like, I just would remember it so clearly. When I heard no, I had to know why. You have to give me exact examples, because my brain is black and white. And when I didn't know why, it would go to, like, crazy temper tantrum.
Yeah.
But the rest of the time, I was super happy, just the best little child in the world, like a little angel. But, like, there wasn't a middle ground. And, you know, my mom had so much trouble, you know, trying to control me, because I was literally either, like, negative 1,000 or, like, 100. Like, just, there was no in the middle. And so it was really hard for her to kind of figure out how to deal with me, especially, you know, because back in Indiana, nobody has, okay, well, you know, how about you go see, you know, a doctor who kind of specializes in this kind of thing, or like have your kids see a counselor. But I mean, that's kind of like, I never remember a time where my emotions weren't, you know, so kind of different. And granted, you know, like my counselor, Because, you know, when that kind of emotional regulation from like zero to like really, really bad is, you know, saw, you always think, oh, well, maybe bipolar. But, you know, I never had like any mania or any, you know, like really bad, like suicidal type depression that was like consistent in waves. So right. That was kind of ruled out. So then you kind of have to think, okay, it's more of just like this really intense emotionality. So, yeah, I think that that's kind of, you know, my whole like background in that.
So what do you think about the role that emotional intelligence plays in all of this? Because I think that's a piece of the puzzle that's getting a little more traction in the conversation these days.
Absolutely. So, you know, for me, and granted, I know that these have different, you know, descriptions, but for
certainly.
Me, emotional intelligence is part of emotional regulation. We have to learn how to regulate our emotions, and that obviously brings up the emotional intelligence, correct?
Yeah.
And so I think that that is so absolutely essential. You know, people have to understand like what they're feeling, how to, like you said, healthily cope with it, because there's plenty of coping mechanisms people can use, whether or not those are damaging or actually helpful. That's kind of what we obviously have to figure out. But no, I think that, you know, emotional intelligence is one of the most important things. And a lot of, because I see a lot of kids that actually have these crazy temper tantrums where, you know, they will be fine and happy 1 minute and then, you know, like punching the younger brother in the face the next minute.
Yeah.
And like moms and dads have a lot of trouble figuring this out. And a lot of my treatment is, granted, there can be, you know, neurotransmitter issues. I use a lot of homeopathy. And then, you know, making sure that there's no trans mineral deficiencies. Diet is huge for kids, but I always make sure that kids learn how to breathe and how to talk through their feelings, how to see, you know, like learn emotional regulation. I use a lot of breathing just because deep breathing stimulates the vagus nerves and it gets people into that parasympathetic mode
yeah.
pretty quickly.
Oh, completely.
But I mean, yeah. And so I think that, like, you know, teaching those kids like early on how to emotionally regulate and how to like learn how to be calm and how to be happy and how to make themselves happy is so absolutely essential. And that's kind of, you know, why the schools that have meditation in their curriculum, like for elementary students, show a lot less, you know, rates of bullying and violent temper tantrums and all that as well, because they kind of have learned regulating emotions.
Yeah, because the bullies are they're sad kids. Something happened to that
yes.
kid.
Yep, exactly. You never know what's happening at home because, yes, they're bullying other kids, but most commonly, somebody's bullying them as well.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of just a lashing out.
That's interesting that the emotional regulation is a part of this conversation as well. That's something that I haven't really considered it, or at least I didn't know that there was a word for it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that is pretty commonly talked about now?
You know, I don't know if it's like the exact term emotional regulation, but I guess most other people say is learn how to control your emotions, because, you know, as human beings, we have emotions. Everybody does. But, you know, most commonly, like, for example, anger, it's fleeting, right? And we can either hold on to that feeling or kind of, you know, let it pass through us. And so that's more on like, I don't really know if I'm answering your question or not, but the emotional
regulation
I'm talking about is just learning how to, you know, like recognize that emotion is passing through you and like move it on. And granted, there are some emotions that are like, you know, for example, like this intense, deep sadness, right?
Yeah.
Or this like, you know, intense, deep, like backline anger. And that's completely different than, you know, I'm talking about like the more of just the fleeting emotions that kind of, you know, somebody steals your parking spot and you can either go key their car and punch in their windows, or you can just say, oh, that's annoying, continue on my day and ignore it, right? Or
yeah.
forget about it or whatever else. And so that's more of the emotional regulation that I feel that children usually have, because they don't necessarily have this like deep, like profound depression. It's more of just, you know, these fleeting moments, getting told no, or somebody stealing their Lego blocks or whatever it is that throws them into this rage. And so that's kind of like the emotional regulation patterns that I believe is super important to have, obviously, early on.
Yeah, because it's harder to start rewiring yourself the older you get.
Oh, absolutely. And it's definitely possible to rewire our brain, but those neuroconnective pathways have been really deeply ingrained for many, many years. So you're working, you know, up a really high mountain versus a little tiny bunny hill.
Yeah. I mean, you don't got to tell me about it. It's
yeah.
It took me a long time to figure that out.
Yeah. And how did you learn your, like, emotional regulation? What was your kind of path towards that?
It was a strange one because it was real winding. It really honestly started when I was young. I was diagnosed with bipolar, and that kind of went back and forth with ADHD, and I was hyperactive. You know, the mania, all the fun stuff. And I ended up having to go into the hospital a couple of times over suicide attempts. And I got on medication and, you know, was trying to do all the right things. But I was just kind of waiting for answers to fall on me. And it wasn't until way later that I realized that's not how this works. I have to do the work. I have to figure it out. So ultimately, it was a matter of trying to engage my empathy that I would have for any other person for myself. Because I had
That's
a big
powerful.
Codependent streak. I was a people pleaser. I still have a bit of that because I'm a performer. Some of that's never going to go away, but I had to learn how to care about myself enough to actually cut myself some slack and start listening. What are the problems? How am I going to be honest about it? And is it too late to clean this up? And as it turns out, it's never too late and you're never really done. You can always be better.
Yes.
So what about
That's
you?
That's so true.
I mean, when did you start figuring out that you were going to put yourself together in a different way?
I think, so I mean, I attribute a lot of my, you know, healing and growth towards my faith. I'm Christian. And so, you know, I definitely bounced around. I grew up in the faith and kind of, you know, had always had that. But unfortunately, mental health is not really talked about in the church.
Right.
You know, and I actually was talking to one of my patients about this today. It's really hard when, you know, people just say, oh, well, just pray about it and be happy, when there's something deeper that you need to do. Sometimes you can't just, you know, pray the devil away. You can't do it. And so, you know, that was like hard for me. And so I kind of, you know, was bouncing around trying to look and try to find, like, you know, what's my soul's purpose? Because for me specifically, my, you know, depression and anxiety, well, my anxiety is kind of just always there, but my depression specifically, when it got at its worst, it was mostly more about this like soul depression where it's like, you know, I just wasn't feeling like filled in my soul.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So that's kind of like what my like flavor of depression revolved around. Right. And so, for me to get over that, I actually was, you know, looking into a lot of other techniques, like, you know, Buddhist and, religions, and trying to figure out like what the heck is going on. And, literally I just had some come to Jesus moment where I remember it so clearly, but I was walking outside after a run, in Chile, and I just like saw everything clearly. And it was just like a weird, like out of body experience. And I just had kind of realized like, okay, like I know my past and like, this is what I need to get on. I need to learn how to like, you know, root down in Christ and kind of make myself happy. And that's kind of like, I don't know, I guess that's kind of what I wasn't on any drugs or anything, but it felt like it, and it was weird.
Yeah.
But that's kind of was my story. And then, I mean, it did not happen overnight. I kind of just recognized, like, I needed my faith to be happy, and I needed to make myself happy. And so, you know, that after 7 years of, like, really working on myself and seeing a counselor and seeing my naturopathic doctor and, you know, being put on homeopathic medicines as well as some other things, that's kind of, like, what my journey was. But I think my biggest thing was exactly like you, like, recognizing, hey, this is my, like, I'm carrying this. Like, nobody in general, like, nobody else is really carrying this for me. I am responsible of my own happiness and my own health. And so I've got to get digging for answers. I've got to, you know, get some help, you know? And so I think that that's kind of what started that and being more proactive to, you know, wanting to get better and then making, you know, making those moves to actually do that.
Yeah. And that's, and because it's not anyone's job to go out of their way to figure out what the solution is. No one can dig around in your brain and figure out what's missing.
Exactly. Yes.
It's quite a process. Yeah, like you said, it didn't happen overnight. I completely believe that, because you're talking about a lifetime of building the pieces of yourself that make up who you are as a human being. I mean, that's not something that just goes away. If you spend more than a year doing something, I mean, that's a part of you. And now multiply that.
Yeah. Yep. It goes deep, and that's kind of like what you're talking about, you know, the retraining your brain and everything, that it's a lot, you know, it's doable at any age, but it's a lot easier, obviously, when you're younger and when you, you know, start on it instead of being like, oh, I'll just do it next year. Or, oh, I'll just do it another time.
Yeah, because when you're a kid, you're still clay. When you grow up, you're more ceramic, and yeah, you can.
Yes.
You got to grind it into a powder and then mix it with some water and try to, you know, reshape it into something different. And it takes a lot more effort. It's possible. It's just a lot harder.
Yes, it is possible, but maybe a little bit more time consuming.
So, I mean, do you see that your patients and the people that you deal with are fairly receptive to the idea of any kind of mental health conversations?
Oh, so granted, and I don't necessarily know if this is just because we are in the West and people are more open-minded in general, but I mean, people come to me and they already know, you know, they've already researched my like site and they've seen, you know, my introductory videos. And I make it clear to my patients, like, we are not just our physical bodies. We are, you know, the emotional aspect, the mental aspect, the spiritual aspect, the physical aspect. Those are all important. And so, you know, I think that most commonly every single person that comes in is, I've never had a person that came in and isn't aware of their emotions, because even, you know, on our new patient intake form, you know, we go in depth about like, you know, anxiety, depression, like any, you know, like we go pretty in depth with any sort of, you know, mental symptom, right?
Yeah.
And so that can really like open the door. And I also ask too, is like, okay, well, are you happy in your marriage? Are you happy in your job? Like, what do you do to make yourself happy? What are your stress relief tools? Like, you know, and so you kind of dig, and then people are pretty open about, you know, opening up and saying, hey, actually, you know, I do deal with a lot of anger and I don't really have a way to regulate it. But sometimes, you know, things don't come out, like the big, deep things don't come out until, like, you know, maybe the second or third visit.
Yeah.
But I feel that people...
Well, you don't want to drop that on somebody right away.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, you'd be surprised when people do, but I always welcome that, because that this is why I love my medicine, because I love talking about this kind of thing.
Yeah.
If you can't tell. But I think that, you know, as you know, when you open the door and kind of like create a safe space so that somebody knows, like, you're not going to judge them, you know, you just want to help them, people kind of let their walls down a little bit and will be open to share a little piece of their internal environment. When you kind of, you know, let them feel safe, you're vulnerable with them, and you know that they know that you are not judging them. That I feel that people, you know, are pretty receptive to that now.
It's a conversation that's pretty fascinating, thinking about mental health, physical health, and everything that basically everything that makes up a human being, and their behaviors and how their behaviors and their thought processes and all of that are having an effect on the body that they're carrying around.
Exactly.
That's pretty amazing.
And, it is unbelievably amazing. And what is so cool to me too, is there is so much research and studies that have came out about, you know, like cancer therapy is a huge one. Like people's mindset actually makes a huge difference on whether they're actually going to survive it or not. Huge research studies on that. And like, for example, music therapy.
Yes.
But one of the best ones that I like is there is a thing called Graves' disease, and it's an autoimmune hyperthyroid disease. So your body is, you know, has antibodies that are actually attacking itself. Graves' disease, within 6 months of contracting Graves' disease, 96% of the patients will have some sort of emotional trauma.
Wow.
Yes. And so, like, that always blows my mind, because, like, it just shows you, too, that, like this disease that is very, very obviously, and, I mean, I have a family history, and, like, you know, literally there was a divorce a couple months before a family member of mine created this, or his body created this disease, right?
Yeah.
And so that's kind of like what prompted my digging into that autoimmune disease. But there is so much research that, you know, shows how our minds have such a huge effect on our physical body. And like, this is just the tip of the iceberg, because, you know, now that mental health is kind of coming to the front and we're like recognizing how powerful our minds and our thoughts are, that is kind of, you know, what's prompting all of these scientific studies and digging deeper into the research about why these diseases are starting in the first place and how we can actually prevent and treat them, you know, with mindfulness and emotional regulation and things like that.
Well, and you hear about things all the time where, like cognitive behavioral therapy can actually mm-hmm. cause physical changes in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's training your brain to be different. I mean, it's like taking your brain to the gym.
Yeah.
That's so, yep, I mean, the fact that you can actually start to reshape your neural pathways and do some work. The fact mm-hmm. that your body will start changing and slowing down, you know, with Alzheimer's, it kind of slows mm-hmm. all the processes, not just the mental faculties. Mm-hmm. I mean, the way that it's all tied together, I guess that's something I hadn't ever really given a conscious thought.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And granted, you know, for me, I get to kind of see firsthand how, you know, this happened. And then, because, like, you always want to ask, too, when any patient comes in, well, what happened before this? And you'd be surprised at, you know, and granted, there can be environmental factors and XXYZ, but you'd be surprised that the emotional, mental things that can trigger physical problems and changes and diseases in the body.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah. And even too, there's some research, and I'm going to quote it wrong because this is a book I read a couple years ago, but it was talking about, like chronic anger was linked to cardiovascular disease, like heart disease. And, cause like I don't know why, but it was just saying how these like specific emotions are actually having linked to, you know, organs, which is crazy.
Well, and it, like there's been studies done that show that suppressing your anger or suppressing your emotions can have negative impacts on cancer patients.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
So in all of this, you're having these conversations with people, and you say that they seem like they're a lot more open than the people, you know, back home in Indy.
Yes, and so I definitely think it's a mental, or not mental, but Midwest thing. But I think the thing is, too, is, you know, a lot of people that are coming to me as, like, a naturopathic doctor are already kind of aware, right?
Yeah.
They, you know, they're already going to an alternative medicine practitioner. They already, you know, are thinking outside the box and recognizing that, you know, there's more to the picture than just XYZ.
Yeah.
You know? And so that might also be kind of why my patients are more kind of receptive to talking about, you know, their mental health and like their struggles and things like that. I don't know. I've never kind of thought about why is it that, you know, and I'm like, well, maybe it's just I don't give them a choice about it. Like, I don't know what's going on, but obviously I give people a choice if they don't want to talk about things. I wouldn't push them. But I've never really sat down and thought, you know, why is this such a big thing here? But I mean, honestly, I keep coming back to the fact that people, it's more of a stigma thing. I feel like if people, like even just your general everyday people in the Midwest were to sit down and talk about like mental health and kind of their struggles and everything, it's hard to say if, you know, it wouldn't be a more open conversation, because I think that the stigma and the closed doors on everything in the Midwest and, you know, that kind of area or whatever, I don't want to talk down the Midwest, wherever it is, if there is closed doors and we're not allowed to talk about mental health, and that's just a stigma that is ingrained in whatever society, then like nobody's going to talk about it. So I think a big thing is, and like I do this with my friends too, is we talk about that kind of stuff. We talk about like anxiety. We talk about depression. Sometimes, you know, we laugh about it, but you know, we get down deep and like talk about like our struggles. And I think having that open door and like friendships and, you know, your communities, I think that's kind of going to be, and granted it's already happening, but I think that's going to be like the biggest kind of push forward to, you know, the mental health kind of sphere and people feeling they're able to talk about things instead of just holding everything in and pretending like they're perfect.
Yeah. I don't even know if it's necessarily a matter of people feeling perfect all the time either. I think that especially in the Midwest, there's a, you know, there's that Midwestern stoicism, you know, that comes along with everyday life. And it's really a matter of just going, well, this is what it is. And, you know, I'm not going to talk about that because I don't have a choice right now. And this is what has to be done. And I'm not better than anybody and nobody's better than me. And I don't have a right to talk about this. And it's ridiculous. Let's shut up and let's set the table. You know, there's that whole aspect of it.
And, you know, honestly, I'm wondering if that's a gender thing.
Because, I think it could be, yeah.
Yeah, because I don't necessarily, I mean, this might just be me personally, but I'm just wondering out loud if, because, like, that sounds to me like, you know, my farmers, right?
Right, yeah, yeah.
That, like, the stoic farmers. And I granted, there are definitely some, you know, farmers' wives that are exactly that stoic, like, let's get things done kind of thing, and we're just going to make it through. But, that's interesting. The stoicism that is very, very prevalent back there. That's very true, and I had not thought about that like that.
Yeah, it's a different thing. I have to wonder how much of that is due to the fact that, you know, things get difficult in the winters, you know? I always felt like that had to be a factor.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, you live a hard life, you can go one of two ways with it. You can either try to fix it, or you can create defense mechanisms for yourself that may or may not be healthy.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, even like in the Great Depression, and like my family, you know, even like a couple generations back, lived in like, you know, pretty poverty type situations, working when they were 14, 15 years old on the railroads, and, you know, getting married at 16,
yeah.
Like popping babies out at 17. And like, so I think that, you know, our grandparents' generations and that kind of era, especially in the Midwest, you didn't have a choice. You had to kind of deal with it, go to work for your family. You weren't going to spend money on a counselor because you didn't have money to spend.
Right.
And that's kind of like a more survival mode, like get through, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Survival mode is exactly right. Yeah. I think that's definitely it. You know, I'm going to talk to somebody. You know, Phil died 2 days ago in the mines, you know, and now I want to talk to somebody because I'm sad. Get out of here with that.
That's so true. Yes.
Yeah.
And because you had to have this life goes on mentality where you just pushed down the emotions, ignored it, and kept going.
Right.
And it wasn't like a thing that anybody talked about. It wasn't something that you could really, you know, process. It was just, this is my life. This is survival. This is what I have to do. That stoicism, exactly. You hit the nail on the head with that one.
Yeah. And learning that process of deciding, you know what, I can decide that I'm going to be stoic and survive, but I'm also mm-hmm. going to be mentally well.
Yes. Yes. That balance.
Yeah, and I think that we're starting to see that more and more as the stigma starts to wear away.
Mm-hmm. No, I completely agree. And also now, too, that, you know, it's more like widely accepted, granted the stigma wearing away, but it's also, I feel that it's easier to kind of get help and like reach out and like talk to somebody about it instead of, you know, feeling isolated with your emotional issues in your little, you know, solo bubble and not really seeing any hope or being talked about.
Yeah, it's something that the internet has been both the blessing and the curse for, because I feel like in a lot of ways it's the cause of and solution to a lot of those feeling alone problems.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yep.
What do you think about that? As far as the way that the social networks are kind of sort of in a way taking away the physical component of being in the same area as a human being.
Yeah, and I truly believe that the internet and social media are, like, as you said, both a blessing and a curse, because, you know, granted it is bringing light to like mental awareness and everything, but it's also sometimes glorifying it.
Yes.
And that's, you know, making it fun. And like, it's definitely the double-edged sword, but I mean, and granted, I'm going to just go off of my patients here because, and granted, this is the same for me, but for example, like I have a lot of, you know, like high school patients with severe anxiety because of what they see on the internet.
Yes.
I mean, eating disorders right now are on the rage because you have to have this perfect body, right? And like, you know, me personally, I dealt with, you know, an eating disorder for many years. And so I know how damaging it is, but I can't imagine being in high school at like this time where you kind of have, you know, everybody around you looking perfect and photoshopped.
Yes.
And, you know, I can't imagine the strain that's going on, you know, in both girls and boys' lives, and seeing this is what I have to look up to and not feeling adequate. And so, and it's hard too, because, you know, me and my significant other, we kind of talk about, you know, how is it that people, we go out to dinner and we don't use our phones.
Like
we look around and you see, you know, kids on their phones, with their parents on their phones, and nobody has, like, family conversations at dinner.
Yeah.
And, like, I mean, my mama, she would have grabbed my phone and not let me seen it for 2 years if I even thought about bringing anything to the table. You know, I had to like, move my book and put up my books, because I was a nerd when I was younger and would read for 15 hours at a time. But I had to, like, put my book in the other room so I could come to the table. And I can't imagine that, like, now kids and their parents are bringing their cell phones in to the table. Like, I don't understand how you can have, like, a healthy family dynamic and making those relationships, talking about your day, talking about your struggles, talk about any bullies at school, talk about anything when everybody is isolating themselves at dinner time.
Yeah. It's a placebo for having conversations. It's like, you feel like you're interacting with people when you're scrolling through a feed. And it is kind of something to pull away from that. I was the same way when I first got a smartphone. I was late to the game, and it only took me about 2 days to be hooked on it. And then something strange happened one day. I used it as a shield, and I realized that I was using it as a negative coping mechanism dealing with some leftover remnants of what used to be a very severe social anxiety. And
yes.
So I was using it, you know, my earbuds and my phone were my armor. Nothing could touch me. I could go out in public. I could take long walks. I was taking public transportation on a regular basis. And one day I was on the bus and I had my phone in my hand and I was just sort of bored scrolling. You know, I might as well have been drooling. And this old man, he looked at me and he said, "Whatever you're looking for, it ain't in there." And then he got off the bus. And that shook me. I was like,
wow.
He is so right. What am I looking for? What do I want? I mean, I took it to the nth degree. And I realized, I'm not connecting with the outside world. I'm not a part of it. I'm out here. I'm in it. There's sounds. There's experiences. There's a lot of great stuff in my phone, but it shouldn't be the only thing I see when I'm out in the world. I live in Denver, Colorado. I can look out my window and see the mountains. You know, why would I want to look at my phone all day? So I've started having a much more... you know, realistic relationship with it, I guess you could say. It's something I'm a lot more mindful of, but it is a conversation. I think in a lot of ways, kids might be getting the impression that they get about behaving the way they do on their phones because they're getting it from their parents. And parents...
Learned behavior.
Yeah, it's learned behavior. Because if given the choice... you know, if there were a plethora of options available, you never know what a kid is going to do. You know,
right?
Kids are unpredictable and noisy and, you know, chaos. And the phone is a pacifier, and you see it with the adults pretty heavily. I find that fascinating. Is that something that you ever have conversations with anybody about? I mean, I'm just curious, like, where that falls or where that's going to fall in the next 10 years, so, because this is still very young technology.
Oh, absolutely. And, for example, with patients like, or kids with ADHD, you know, or people that are even like, you know, predisposed to ADHD.
Yeah.
Phones and technology, I have seen, make this, especially with kids, a lot worse, just because their mind is already going at such a high rate and the phone can keep up with their mind because it goes super fast as well, right?
Yeah.
You know, we're able to click on things and go, go, go. But unfortunately, like, there's no time that's turning off. Their mind isn't, like, turning off and getting into that parasympathetic, like, calming mechanism. And so it kind of just ramps up their minds a lot more. And, you know, our stress and, you know, for example, when kids are watching and playing video games on their phone, and it's kind of like, you know, they feel that like adrenaline rush, like, that's not good. Because the thing is what that adrenaline rush is it's actually your adrenals, which are these two little glands that sit on top of your kidneys, and they will release, you know, epinephrine and norepinephrine, which is your adrenaline, as well as cortisol. Cortisol, all of these are kind of released when we're running from the lion, right? You know, we're out on the plains, we're running from the lion, and these get released.
Yeah.
Right? Our body doesn't know whether it's in a stressful situation from like a video game or from running from a lion.
Right.
But our body does the exact same thing. It does the same thing by, you know, switching off our digestion, because we're not wanting to digest our food when we need to have our, you know, energy into our limbs so that we can run. It will, you know, lower our immune system. It will make our mind go a lot more, but it won't let us, you know, rest. And so especially with kids who have, you know, they're playing video games and like, you know, on their phone up right up until they go to bed, and then they lay awake for another 4 hours before they go to bed, and they only get 2 hours, 3 hours of sleep.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, duh, because two reasons here. The phone is stimulating their mind. They're not going to be able to turn it off. Their cortisol levels are through the roof, and they're not going to be able to sleep. So they're not going to be able to heal their little bodies and develop properly. And the second thing is actually the light from their phone is creating cortisol levels to be higher. So cortisol is absolutely a beautiful hormone. It will peak in the morning, and then it will kind of, you know, stay stable during the day, and it will go back or go down at nighttime when the sun goes down. During the night, it stays really low. Cortisol can also be stimulated by light. That's why it's so important to sleep in a really dark room. So when kids are, you know, having this light from their phone that's directly in their eyes, that actually will wake their body up. And so that is, you know, just another reason why, you know, phone time should be completely cut off at least an hour before bedtime. I mean, ideally it would be 2 hours before bedtime.
Yeah.
But at least an hour before bedtime, nobody should be, you know, looking at their phone if they want to sleep as deep as they possibly could, which means heal as deep as they possibly could. But yeah, I see this all the time, and it's a hard conversation to have with people, but I mean, the studies, it's black and white to me. So it's like, well, this is the information, so.
Right. Yeah, but essentially, I mean, you know, try telling people, you know, to put away the legal crack.
Yes.
It's like, yeah, that's okay, Dr. Buzzkill. I'll get right on that.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, so, you know, that is interesting. I wonder how that's going to play out over the course of the next couple of decades. That's going to be interesting. You know, it's been a hell of a conversation. This has really been amazing, and I can't thank you enough for agreeing to come on and drop all this knowledge on us.
Oh, of course. Yeah. No, I thank you. I've been really, really enjoying this. I've been looking forward to it. And, you know, maybe we'll, you know, match up and talk again sometime, because I quite enjoyed this as well.
Yeah, we'll have to follow up and see how all of this shakes out.
Yes.
Thanks for talking to me today.
Okay. Of course. You have a wonderful rest of your weekend.
Thank you. You too. And there you have it. That was really awesome. I cannot thank people enough for coming on the show and having the courage to have these conversations. And Dr. Mariah is no exception. If you want more Dr. Mariah Mosley in your life, and I know you do, you can go to naturecurefamilyhealth.com and you can find her in there. You can also go to facebook.com/DrMosleyNMD and let her know what you thought of the episode. As for me, I've got some music stuff coming up that hopefully I'll be able to announce through the podcast at some point soon. But I can't really let the cat out of the bag on that just yet. So for now, just know I'm working on some things. I'm taking care of myself. And as always, don't kill yourselves out there.